This is Louisiana Considered on WWNL in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack. Just ahead on today's show, award-winning soprano Katrina Galka stops by for a chat. She sings the role of Lucia as the New Orleans Opera Association closes its season with Donizetti's Lucia de Lammermoor. And we'll hear about an effort to legalize some forms of gambling in Louisiana's neighbor, Alabama. But first, college basketball is back at the top of sports fans' minds. The annual March Madness tournament kicked off this week. Two Louisiana men's teams, McNeese State and Grambling State, will compete. LSU will participate in the women's tournament. Other than what happens on the court, another question has dominated the tournament and all of college sports as of late. How much should college athletes be paid for their work, and how has that changed sports? Dr. Jamira Mitchell is a Baton Rouge-based career and technical education teacher at University View Academy, a K-12 virtual school, and host of the podcast, The NIL Spot. And she joins us now. Hi, Jamira. Welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
First, NIL. That stands for Name, Image, Likeness. Can you explain why that's a big deal for college athletes?
Well, it's really a big deal because now student athletes can monetize from their name, image, and likeness. Years ago, you either had to move on to the professional level to get paid, or you had to be an amateur, as we called it before. But now amateurs can now get paid for their name, image, and likeness. And name being the surname that you were given to by your parents, image being that which you see in pictures or that which you hear, and then your likeness, those things that are personalized to you, such as your nickname.
Now, does that mean Louisiana student athletes playing in March Madness are earning money just for playing, and how much?
Well, if it was that simple, I think everybody would be interested. But unfortunately, student athletes are not getting paid just to be a part of March Madness, but instead they are able to monetize maybe from social media posts, maybe from business deals that they already have, business deals that they are creating because they are making it to March Madness. So they really aren't getting paid to be there, but they are getting paid based on the brand that they have created for themselves.
And how is that different from past tournaments?
So past tournaments, they were not able to make any kind of monetization from their name, image, and likeness. They were just there because, of course, they loved the game and because they were just excited to be seen on the national level. But now, based on the brand that they've created for themselves, they can make money from their sponsors and from many other brand deals that they may create either before going into March Madness or after March Madness, should they decide to go to the next level, which is professional play, or should they decide to come back to their school for another year of play.
This is Louisiana Considered from WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. I'm Diane Mack. Dr. Jamira Mitchell is a Baton Rouge-based educator and host of the podcast, The NIL Spot. Can you help us understand how NIL has influenced other college sports teams in Louisiana? I'm thinking of LSU football and how big that team is.
Yes, so I think NIL has really changed the scope of things as far as, you know, before student athletes were just known as amateurs. They were just known as, you know, this is what we do for our scholarship. But now it's taken it to another level and student athletes are able to be the brands among themselves. They're able to negotiate deals. They're able to monetize from it. And I think it also makes it balanced. So the student athletes that are giving up all of their time, all of their energy, they are now, you know, being thought of as, okay, you are here, we're glad you're here. And those student athletes that may not have been able to have a pizza to celebrate after their game, they can now afford that pizza. And so that is why I think NIL is such a great thing for especially those athletes that are, maybe financially struggling, maybe first generation students. So you having that flexibility and that ability is great.
Now, the Louisiana High School Athletic Association voted to allow students to earn money in 2022, correct?
Yes.
How has that changed high school sports in the state?
I don't think it's really changed high school sports in the state because many student athletes and their parents on the high school level are really not that in tune with NIL. A lot of coaches and a lot of, it's still murky water to say the least. But that's not just on the high school level, it's also on the collegiate level. So it's more of getting that education and truly understanding how to monetize from your name, image, and likeness, understanding that even though you are monetizing from your name, image, and likeness, you can still be considered as an amateur. But you also have to understand the do's and don'ts, such as, there are certain commercials you may be able to be in, but you, of course, cannot have any of your school logos associated with it. Or there are certain brands that you shouldn't be a part of. So I think it's again going back to establishing a personal brand, knowing your personal brand, and then moving and venturing out.
You covered NIL collectives in a recent episode. Can you explain what those are, and do they have a big presence in Louisiana sports?
Yes, so collectives. So there is a difference between collectives and NIL deals. So collectives is think about the root word collecting or collect. So it's a group of people that are just lovers of their school and they want to make sure that their student athletes have the opportunity to monetize from their name, image, and likeness. So they simply collect their money. They put it in an organization and then that organization then distributes to either to a particular student athlete or to a particular team. Now, an NIL deal, it is usually one-on-one. So it is usually the student athlete and a brand, or it is the student athlete and or a few student athletes and one brand. In the state of Louisiana, on the collegiate level, there are collectives that are around. Of course, on the high school level, so far, there really aren't collectives yet because we are still trying to understand NIL for high school students. So there are collectives on the collegiate level, and it is doing very well to make sure student athletes have that opportunity to receive some of the monetization.
If listeners are student athletes or they have student athletes in their lives, what are some good ways to understand their rights in this new environment?
Ask questions. The dumbest question, of course, is the question not asked. If you do not understand things, make sure you ask on the collegiate level as soon as you receive an NIL deal. Make sure you speak with your compliance officer so they can lead you into the direction as you need to move into. Make sure you always have a financial person, someone that will help you with your taxes. And also, just read. Try to find out as much information as you can about NIL, about the financial words, such as ROI, which is return on investment. Make sure you look to see what state that your student athlete is going to be playing in. See what laws are in the states that you live in, just to make sure that you and your student athlete truly understand. But make sure you ask as many questions as possible.
Dr. Jemira Mitchell, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jemira Mitchell is a Baton Rouge-based career and technical education teacher at University View Academy, a K-12 virtual school, and host of the podcast, The NIL Spot. An effort to legalize some forms of gambling is underway in Louisiana's neighbor, Alabama. The issue has fallen short for decades, and this year's plan has once again run into stiff opposition. What could legal sports betting look like in Alabama? The Gulf States Newsroom's Joseph King looks to neighboring states like Louisiana that have already taken the leap to find out more.
It's mid-February, and dozens of people are packing to Ghost Train Brewing in Birmingham, Alabama, watching Super Bowl 58. Something like 68 million sports fans across the world bet on this year's Super Bowl. Many, like George Musto, use sports betting apps on their phones.
I'm a Detroit Lions fan.
But the Lions are not playing today, so...
I put money on the Chiefs because I can afford to bet on the Chiefs right now. And I think that's what it should be all about, is enjoying the excitement, being able to make an extra source of income, and make yourself more excited while watching the game.
Now, this kind of sports betting in Alabama is not exactly legal, but that hasn't stopped people from trying. According to the popular online gambling company FanDuel, they blocked at least 2 million attempts for Alabamians to place online sports bets in 2023. Nick Coleman, who is sitting a little ways away at the bar, says he thinks it should be legal, and he's going to do it anyway.
100%. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a sin, but, I mean, to each his own. If that's what I want to do, let me do it, you feel me?
He says it's about time Alabama catches up with other states.
At least put the power in the hands of the people in the state to choose if that's what they want to do.
Coleman's opinion is shared by a lot of people, not only in Alabama, but in the Deep South as a whole. That includes Alabama's governor, Kay Ivey. During her most recent State of the State address, she announced her support for a gaming bill that's making its way through the legislature.
I believe the current proposal being contemplated by the legislature is good for Alabama.
That version of the bill would have brought the lottery, casinos, and sports betting to the state. Now, that bill has been slimmed down. Lawmakers even pulled sports betting out of it recently, and it's still not clear if it will make it to the finish line, even with the governor's support. If it does, it will put the issues in front of voters in a special election in the fall. This is not the first effort to legalize sports betting in Alabama. Supporters of the bill say the state is leaving millions of dollars in tax revenue on the table. Take Louisiana, for example, which began allowing online sports betting in 2021.
It's just a crazy number. It's much bigger than what we had anticipated.
Ronnie Johns is the chairman of the Louisiana Gaming Control Board. He says since the inception of sports betting, over $5 billion have been wagered in the state. Johns says that has generated around $85 million for Louisiana. Those funds are used on things like early childhood education, local government, and towards treatment for people suffering from compulsive gambling.
We're one of the very few states in America that actually maintains a public facility for compulsive gamblers where at no cost to them, they can get treatment. And then a lot of it's also done outpatient. But we fund a lot of that through our gaming taxes, sports betting, as well as the casino proceeds go into compulsive gambling programs.
Gambling addiction is something people who oppose Alabama's attempt to legalize sports betting bring up a lot. The current version of the state's gambling bill will set some money aside to help people deal with that. The latest version of Alabama's bill has a long way to go, so it definitely won't pass in time for the NCAA Men's Division I basketball tournament, better known as March Madness, later this month. Last year, an estimated $15 billion was likely wagered during the tournament. And much like the Super Bowl, it's pretty much guaranteed that gamblers in Alabama are going to be in that mix, whether it's legal or not. For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Joseph King.
The Gulf States Newsroom is a partnership among public radio stations in Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Marriage, madness, and murder are in the mix as the New Orleans Opera Association closes its 81st season with Donizetti's Lucia de Lammermoor. Award-winning soprano Katrina Galka takes center stage as Lucia, and she joins us now. Katrina, welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Thank you so much for having me, Diane.
As you return to New Orleans after your 2019 debut to take center stage now in this operatic thriller, what goes through your mind as you are performing it in the city where it made its first U.S. appearance back in 1841?
Yeah, I learned that after I got here, and I just thought that's such a cool history. And this company especially loves Lucia di Lammermoor. I know that this company has done this piece many, many times. So I actually do feel like I'm part of a very rich history. And I feel like I'm really well taken care of because this is my first time doing this role. And it is a tour de force. It really puts everything you got out there. But I feel really, really supported. And I'm really excited for this debut.
And on that note, tell us more about yourself. Where did you grow up? And when did you realize that you were blessed with the gift of song?
Well, I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And like there was something in my heart that just said, you need to sing and you need to be on stage. And I was lucky enough to live in a community that had like a lot of community theater for whatever reason. There were community shows, there were professional theater in Milwaukee, there were a lot of school shows. And I just really ate it up. Like something in me was drawn to that. And I would ask my parents if we could go to all the shows. And the middle school, they would have a VHS recording of their middle school musical. And when I was in first grade, I'd say to my mom, we need to buy it. And, you know, it was really for the families to kind of record the the experience that, oh, our kids did this, but I wanted to watch it over and over again. Because I looked up to those kids and I just loved that art form so, so much. So, yeah, those were my early introductions. And I was really lucky to be surrounded by so much singing and theater.
Did you go on to formal training?
I did. Yes. Those were the early days. And then I ended up going to Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, where I studied with Barbara Hill Moore. And then I went on to get my master's degree from Boston University, where I studied with Penelope Beatsis. I did 1 year with Boston University's Opera Institute. And then I went on to be a young artist with Portland Opera, Arizona Opera. And I did summers with Opera Theater St. Louis and Glimmer Glass Festival.
Wow.
So lots and lots of training.
Yeah. And I understand you graduated with highest honors.
I did. Yeah.
Lucia di Lammermoor is one of opera's most performed works around the world. What is it based on and where is it set?
So it's based on a novel written by Sir Walter Scott. And it's set in Scotland during the 17th century. We have Lucia Ashton. She is a very young girl and she's, you know, part of a noble family. So her brother is in a position of power and the family has just lost all their power. Her mother has recently died. She's finding herself in a vulnerable position already. And her brother feels a lot of pressure to regain whatever power, whatever standing he can. And so he really wants Lucia to get married. There's an option for a politically advantageous marriage here if she marries this man named Arturo. However, Lucia has met this other man, Edgardo, who she has fallen head over heels in love with. And very similar to Romeo and Juliet, the two families, Edgardo's family and Lucia's family, they are complete enemies, political, mortal enemies. And so, of course, she's fallen in love with the enemy. And that is something that her brother cannot stand. And from there, the drama really unfolds and it sends her into just deep, deep turmoil. And we see her being a victim of abuse, psychological, physical, mental, over and over again from the time the opera starts.
Can we talk more about some of the themes that are being explored in this work?
We have like female agency and power. What does that mean at that time? And, you know, for a modern audience looking at it today, it really stands out to us. You know, we know so much more about the effects of abuse and trauma and how that can lead to mental instability. And that's definitely a big theme in this show. We also see conflicting loyalties. Does she stay true to her family line, you know, her brother, or does she stay true to her heart? And then, of course, like just this total heartbreak that comes from that division of what is the best way for her to move in the world. How does she stay true to herself and to all the people and things she's been taught to stay true to?
Now, you touched a little on mental illness, and this opera is best known for its mad scene where Lucia spirals into an uncontrollable breakdown. How did you prepare for it?
Yeah, so there's this very, very famous last scene that in total is around 20 minutes long. And Lucia comes out and she's covered in blood. Sometimes in our production, I'll come out with the knife that I just killed my new husband with. The challenge of this role is that Lucia sings a lot before she sings the 20-minute mad scene. So by the time you get there, there's an element of vocal stamina. There's an element of emotional stamina because here you are, you're acting crazy. And the way that we're thinking of it, and this is my first time, so maybe there'll be other ways that I go forward, but I mean, really, what feels clear in the music too is that she's breaking from reality. She's almost reliving the memory of a marriage that she wishes had happened, the marriage that she wishes she could have had with her love, Edgardo. However, she's walking the path that she had just walked in her actual fated marriage with Arturo. And so we see that divide. And it's, I think, really haunting to see that in her mind, she's living this happy fantasy, even though she's just clearly committed a really atrocious, tragic crime, you know, of murder. How did I prepare that? I spend time with the text. I spend time listening to the music. And then I think about what would it feel like if I were in that scenario? And then I just kind of turn over to my impulses in the moment. I really just trust what happens when I'm present with all of those elements. And then, of course, we have an amazing team. We have Brenna Korner directing, we have Joseph Mekovich conducting. You know, that's where things really start to come alive for me because I can play off of their suggestions as well. And you know, sometimes too, you can think of little things like what would be a physical symptom of insanity, right? How can I actually show this from time to time if I ever need to? But I don't try to make that the core of what I'm doing. I try to make the core of what I'm doing just being present in the reality of the words, the music, and the general state that I think Lucia is in.
Is there a big takeaway or a lesson for audiences?
I hope that people leave and their hearts have been opened, like that they are connected to their own human compassion and empathy, and that they question too the ways that these themes and like the ways that we treat each other, that that's still alive in our world today. I think it's really easy to say, oh, this was set in the 17th century, or this was, you know, Donizetti wrote this in the 19th century, and we're not, like, we're so beyond that. And I don't really know if that's always true. So I think these works are meant to open our hearts and make us question our humanity as a whole. Yeah.
Award-winning soprano, Katrina Galka, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure talking with you, too. Thank you for having me.
The New Orleans Opera Association presents Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor. Performances run Friday, March 22nd, and Sunday, March 24th, at the Mahalia Jackson Theater. More info is online at neworleansopera.org. From WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge, you've been listening to Louisiana Considered. I'm Diane Mack. Thanks to our guest, Dr. Jemira Mitchell, educator and host of the podcast, The NIL Spot. Joseph King from the Gulf States Newsroom and award-winning soprano, Katrina Galka. Our managing producer is Alana Schreiber. Our contributing producers are Matt Bloom and Adam Voss. We receive production and technical support from Garrett Pittman and our assistant producer, Ari Purcell. You can listen to Louisiana Considered Monday through Friday at noon and 7 p.m. on this station. It's available on Spotify, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcast.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Louisiana Farm Bureau Federation.